Let's have a chat with another real person, Judy Okaya, in this, the 95th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Oh, hi, everybody. Welcome back. Thank you, as always, for listening. Today, we have another real person chat where I will be talking with Judy Okaya. Judy is a member of the Facebook group, and she was one of the original members. I don't know exactly what date, but when I started the group in April of 2020, she was one of the first ones to join and has been very active since. And it was clear from the beginning, she definitely knows what she's talking about, is well-versed in all of this, etc. And I just thought she was a knowledgeable DIYer who clearly has an aptitude and liking for this. But come to find out, in doing this chat with her, as you'll soon hear, her career prior to retiring was actually as a retirement actuary for pension plans. So we'll talk a little more about what that is. But basically, Judy's been in and around retirements for her whole life. But difference is, she worked on the sort of corporate, like, you know, plans, that large pensions for large companies and other retirement plans like that, not doing like the personal individual retirement planning things, which were things that she kind of had to learn herself along the way. But, you know, I guess a good knowledge base from having been in and around concepts of retirement and pension plans and such, that she had a good base of, info and knowledge from which to learn from. So anyway, without further ado, I bring you my chat with Judy Okaya. So welcome back, everyone. Thank you for watching and listening. As always, we have another great real person episode today with Judy Okaya. Hello, Judy.
Hey, Andy.
Thank you for joining. I'm honored and pleased that you're here. So for those who are in the Facebook group and don't know, Judy is one of the original members from back in early 2020. Frequent contributor, great contributor, has a lot of good things to add. So I definitely appreciate all of your time and effort in the group, Judy. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for inviting me.
You're on the hot seat now. No. but before we get into it, I just want to let you know that the first floor is going great, but the second floor, well, that's another story. Judy, do you get it? And yeah, I put my old car into reverse the other day. Man, that took me back.
Okay.
Yeah, it's so bad. They're really so bad. That's what makes them.
When I started listening, I used to take down this your dad joke, and okay. I used to use it.
Good. Well, you can use those two now.
Yeah.
All right. So with all the fun and games aside now, so Judy, can you give a little background about yourself? Sort of retirement status, age, if you're willing to share, et cetera?
Sure, yeah. I turned 60 February of this year. Been retired for almost 5 years. In April 1st, April Fool's Day 2019 is when I retired.
Did you really? Or are you joking?
There you go.
It doesn't stop.
Yeah, no. I mean, my coworkers then, you know, are you really retiring on April Fool's Day, or are you playing a joke? And I said, no, I am retiring. Well, I had turned 55 the February before in 2019, and 55 is the earliest retirement age. My I celebrated my 50th birthday traveling with my parents, and they were 80 at that time. And it was the first, you know, when you spend time with your parents, I don't know when you realize that they're actually old. They're actually slowing down. And I think it was the first time that I realized they're actually slowing down. They're having a difficult time now. And that's when I started thinking about, you know, wanting to spend more time with them. I used to think that I would not retire early because I love my job. And I did like my job until the end, but then, you know, the priorities have changed. So I retired when the calculator said, you can retire, then I did.
Okay. And what was your job? What did you retire from?
I was a consulting retirement actuary. So I worked on pension plans. I advised, large companies on how to fund, design, comply with all the rules regarding their pension plan, retirement plans, primarily, defined benefit plans, but also defined contribution plan, 401ks. And then in the last couple of years of my employment, I was also involved in financial well-being initiatives of our company. So financial wellness offerings to employees. So, yeah.
Okay. Very cool. And you are in California, is that correct?
I'm in California. Okay. I'm in California, one of the highest tax states. And it's actually how I found you, because shortly after I retired, I was thinking about taxes in retirement, which is what your group used to be called, taxes in retirement. And of course, all knowing Facebook, kind of knows everything about you and
right.
knew that I was thinking about it. And somehow, your group showed on my feed. And that's how I learned about you.
It's scary how they get in your head and know what you're thinking and can spoon feed you things relevant to what's in your head. It's really kind of scary.
Yes, it's scary and at the same time convenient. So
right.
So let's say I'm thinking of going to Japan and suddenly I don't know where they get the information. That's the scary part. And suddenly there's all these ads about Japan or all these groups posts about Japan. So
right. It's quite impressive. And so you mentioned your parents a handful of years ago, you realized they were finally aging. Are they directly involved in your planning, your financial life? Do you have any other significant others involved as well in your planning considerations?
Yeah. No, I have my wife of 32 years now, not legally married. We were married when California allowed recognize the marriages.
Okay.
But we've been together for 32 years. We don't have kids. The timing of when we wanted kids, we just didn't match. So when she wanted, I didn't. When I wanted, she didn't. And now it's too late. We're just retiring. So.
Sure. Okay. And are your parents dependent on you or are they not?
My parents used to live with me. I was looking after them. A retirement problem is at some point inflation erodes your purchasing power and, you pretty much use up your retirement savings. So that's happened to them. They were staying with us for a while, but now that they're in their 90s, my father, he was not born here, so he's an immigrant, but he was thinking, I'm ready to go. I'm close to going. I'm in the boarding area, as he would say it. And that's where I want to be buried. So that's where I want to go now. That's where I want to stay. And so it's been difficult balancing and respecting what they want versus doing what you think is best for them. But in the end, respecting what they want and figuring out how to deal with that is top the other considerations.
So. Right, of course. And thank you for sharing. I don't mean to pry, but when you mentioned your parents, it was something that other folks haven't specifically brought up, talking about their parents. And I just figured if your parents are directly involved or, part of your plans, involve them financially, personally, whatever. Other folks may benefit from the knowledge as well, or sort of have similar circumstances where they're potentially caring for parents or parents live with them or, financially supporting parents. So that's why I was asking. It wasn't just simply Andy being nosy.
Oh, sure. No. I think more and more people are being involved with what's happening to their parents. Some are able to help some aren't. It's a tough situation, I think, especially if the, parents didn't save enough for their retirement. But it's a, you know, very good learning experience as well, kind of foreseeing, okay, if I don't do this, I might end up, you know, like that, and I don't want that kind of stuff. So
right. Broad sort of question, but you're in retirement. What are your financial goals and priorities? And the other side of that, what's your non-financial goals and priorities for your retirement?
Sure. So not running out of money.
That's always a good one.
Yeah. That's not running out of money. Living comfortably until we pass away.
Okay.
And not letting emotions affect our financial investment decisions. So helping when we can, helping to the extent we can, helping others, helping family, helping other people, less fortunate people. Non-financial, travel, experience as much as we can while we still can, reconnect with old friends. As I travel, I started looking for who lives in this area, who lives in this country that I could see, friend, relative, whatever. And I find that more satisfying than going to the tourist spots.
Sure.
And whatnot. So, but we still, our travel is still dictated by where we want to go, but we just kind of wanted to, okay, can we take time out? And is there someone we can see living in this part of the world? Yeah.
Right. Good. And I assume, so you retired around pandemic time. I guess your travel plans and visiting other people plans were sort of squashed for a while, but I assume now you're sort of back to a point where you are able to get out and about and meet folks and are fulfilling that goal.
Yeah. Yeah. That was disappointing because travel was a big part of what we're going to do when I retired. And then, lockdowns and all that happened. So when things opened up, it's just like, you were traveling with vengeance. So.
Make up for lost time.
Make up for lost time. Yeah.
So I just wanted to go back briefly. You mentioned that one of your goals is to not let emotions drive the decision-making processes. So I assume from your responses I've seen in a Facebook group, you seem very pragmatic, thoughtful, and, you know, it appears you wouldn't let emotions drive your decision-making. I'm curious, your wife is different at all? Like, are one of you more or less emotion-driven or... you know, don't think things through necessarily objectively before making decisions.
Yeah. Well, that's a challenge. She doesn't want to be involved with financial stuff. I keep, trying to get her more involved, more interested. Sometimes, I would tell her something and she doesn't pay attention, but she sees it in social media and she pays attention. And she said, oh, I heard about this. Oh, do we have this stock? Are we invested in this? And I posted a comment actually in your Facebook group one time, and it was a joke, something like, I probably should start learning how to do YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, because it seems my spouse listens to that before she would listen to me.
Right.
So, but slowly but surely. He's getting,
okay.
Getting better involved.
Better late than ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you start getting serious about planning for your retirement?
I was thinking about this. It's funny because I was a retirement actuary. So for 25, 30 years, that's the business I was in, right? So you'd think I was planful about my own retirement. And I'm embarrassed to admit that I wasn't. I saved for retirement. So that I did. But learning about, you know, taxation and retirement, learning about, well, how big is the ACA subsidy and Affordable Care Act subsidy or the income related Medicare adjustment amount, IRMA, right? I did not learn those until after I retired. I knew about Social Security tax torpedo.
Okay.
And up to a certain level, you know, when your income is at a certain level, more of your Social Security benefit gets taxed. So I knew about that before retiring. Healthcare costs, I had an idea of how much it would cost us when I retired, but I never really thought about, you know, strategizing with, you know, take into account ACA subsidy.
Sure.
I never really thought about it until after I retired. So, yeah, I was so into my work up until the time that, you know, I was almost retiring a few months before I retired. And partly, you know, you hear people advise other people don't retire not knowing what you're going to do, you know, retire to something, right? But in my head, I was so busy with work, I couldn't figure out what I was going to do. So I thought, well, I'll just retire and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do because I'll have all the time to figure out, you know, what's important and what I want to do. So,
Okay.
I did a lot more planning shortly after I retired. Yeah.
And you said April 2020. 2020 was when you
2019.
Retired? 2019. I'm sorry. Okay. Never mind. I was going to ask, did pandemic change that? But that was, I got the year off. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I was 2019. COVID happened. And then Lee, my spouse, retired in 2020 during COVID.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what, obviously the taxes and retirement group was helpful, I assume. But besides that, what sources, what places did you go to learn the things you've since learned and wanted to find out?
I actually interviewed advisors before I retired and hired one a few months after I retired. I knew, I didn't know what I didn't know. Right.
Yeah.
And I knew that I really didn't plan very well. I just know we had enough. What we have could support our desired lifestyle.
And that was that based on what? Like, how did you know you had enough? What did you use for that?
Oh, various retirement calculators. So calculator okay. through the 401k, the brokerage, and other calculators, my former boss's calculator, things like that.
Okay. And they all said yes and agreed with one another. So that gave you confidence that, okay, these answers must be right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You can retire with your salary, you know, your income in retirement will be about your salary right now. I'm like, okay, I know I can live on that. So I can live on that.
Okay.
So yeah, but so I hired an advisor. I interviewed a bunch of advisor. I started consuming podcasts, YouTube videos, and all of that. Christine Benz of Morningstar started following what she said, and then sometimes she would reference a book and I would look up that book and begin reading that book. So, and then in your group and Facebook group and other groups, someone would recommend a book. So, I'd look up that book and buy them. I thought about getting studying for the credentials, but not really practicing. So I thought about studying for the RICP. Credential, the CRPC credential. I knew I didn't want to be go for the CFP because I thought, well, that's more than what I need, right? But I look into, well, what are people reading? What's on the curriculum? What are they studying? So if I find something that, oh, this looks like it's they're studying this for a master's program in financial planning, then I try to get a hold of that and read. So
that's a great idea. That's a really smart way to go about it. The curriculums for things like the RICP you mentioned, Retirement Income Certified Professional, it's like $2,000 maybe, which isn't cheap, but you don't have to actually go so far as to take the test and get the credentials. It's just really good education specific toward retirement financial planning. So it's a great way to get like a custom crafted, relatively concise, here's what you need to know about all these things type package. So that was thoughtful.
Yeah, because I think especially after I parted ways with the financial advisor. So we were together for maybe 10 months. And then I realized, and I think he realized also, that we weren't a good fit. So we parted ways. And then around that time, also, I joined your group and got a better idea of what I wanted from an advisor.
Okay.
Right? But during that process, because I let go of my advisor, I thought, well, I better learn this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And even when I hire an advisor, I'm a trust but verify kind of person. No one's really going to care more about your situation than yourself. So
right.
I thought, well, I better learn this stuff if I'm not going to hire. I think, retirement is too important and too difficult to kind of do on your own. And especially since you don't know what you don't know and things constantly change, right? So, yeah.
And how did you know the advisor wasn't a good fit, if you don't mind sharing? I'm sure lots of people have advisors and they don't know what they don't know. Like, how do they know when it's time to move on, whether amicably or not, that this person isn't the right fit for them?
So this advisor was a flat fee advisor, so he had that right.
Mm-hmm.
The advice was primarily how we would invest our money, our savings, right?
Okay.
When our asset allocation was put together and all the funds and stuff like that, what I got was, one for the 401k, a separate one for the brokerage. It wasn't like the entire portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
It was all separate. And I thought that was strange. And then consuming videos there was a 5-year tax planning. So there was that. And I don't know if it's because we weren't together long enough, right? But things about thinking about Irma or thinking about strategizing for, regarding ACA subsidy, those were not part of the conversation.
Okay.
And so I thought, no, this is not the right thing. And then COVID also tested the relationship, right? When things went down all of a sudden and everybody was freaking out. This is the end of everything, right? I told you, I don't want emotions to impact our the way we invest our money. So, and I knew I needed an accountability partner to prevent me from jumping off the cliff. But I got to the point where I almost jumped off the cliff, right? And you were scared about it. But we thought about, this is the time to do tax loss harvesting. Let's get out, but then go back in.
Yep.
And he was able to get me out and have the losses, but didn't go back in quickly enough in my mind. But even though that's what we agreed, I think it was just chaotic. Maybe his practice was chaotic or something. So that was overlooked. But then I thought, okay, first of all, if I can't respect him enough to not be emotional and just follow the advice, then
then
I need another type of advisor.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Great points. It makes a lot of sense. How would you rate your knowledge of retirement related financial investing tax issues? I rate it as above average, but I'm curious what you think of yourself on a self-assessment basis.
Yeah, I would also think I'm above average. I would hope I'm above average. My,
it was your job.
My career was in retirement, right? Yeah. Although it was a retirement for institution, right?
Sure.
But since I retired, I've consumed a lot of material also that pertains to retirement on an individual basis. I like I said, I'm a trust but verify kind of person, so I question a lot of conventional thinking. And I probably don't think like most do in that sense. Like, for example, asset allocation, you know, typically it's okay, the standard is 60-40, right? 60% equities, 40% fixed income. And I'm thinking, but why, right? But why that? And then typically you'd be asked, you know, are you risk averse or aggressive? Are you conservative or aggressive? Okay, conservative, then maybe you're 50-50. Aggressive, then maybe you're okay with 70-30 and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's not enough for me. So I look at my projected drawdowns and the risks that I face, right? And my asset allocation is based on that, based on what investments or assets should I have to address this risk or that risk or that risk. There is not one investment or one asset that would address various types of risk. So, okay, what's my best guess on what's best for this type? So that's how I kind of think of things.
That's good. I think the standard 60-40 is what the typical retiree should be, is nothing more than rule of thumb, respectable enough starting point. But like you said, there's lots of other things that go into it. What's the purpose and reason behind each investment? Do you have it just because some article says you should, or you've thought through what its use is, what your risk tolerance is? Are you more or less risky or conservative than the norm? Like, all these things come into play. And for what it's worth, I struggle with what is the right asset allocation. It's not an exact science. Whether someone's 50-50, 60-40, 70-30, those aren't dramatically different. 30-70 is a world of difference, obviously. But give or take 5, 10 percentage points, it's like we're kind of bumping around in the margins now. Is this going to matter? And if so, how? But anyway, that aside, it's definitely not something you can just do because rule of thumb or an article says you should. Everyone, whether you work with an advisor or not, should have a more thoughtful, diligent rationale behind what they invest in. So clearly you do that.
Yeah. It's the comfort level is different for every individual, right?
Right.
So to me, I know myself well enough that I could be emotional. I'd seen myself, being emotional about the investment. The mind knows what's the right thing to do, but when it comes down to yourself and what you need to do for yourself, sometimes, you don't really follow what you know, right? And that's why I think some advisors have their own advisors.
Yes.
It's not that they don't know necessarily, but they're aware enough of what the risks are, and they know they need a partner for that. And I don't know how we got to this, but I wanted to say that I think everyone should hire an advisor, and it doesn't have to be a lifelong relationship, right?
Yeah.
Maybe someone who's knowledgeable only needs 2 years to learn. And during that process, learn a lot from that advisor. Kind of like if you're going to have a master's degree on something, because you have a very good foundation, okay, maybe you only need 2 years. Or maybe you don't have a good enough foundation and you need 4 years from an advisor and learn from them. Or maybe, you really don't want to be bothered by a lot of it. Or if your priorities are different, and you want to delegate that main process of overseeing what you've got, and you have a longer relationship with advisor. But I think retirement is so important, and it's so easy to get wrong. That if you don't have the time, the knowledge, and the self-awareness, it's good to, and this sounds like a plug for an advisor, but me, I don't have an advisor currently, but I know that at some point I will again. But yeah, it's there's no mulligans, right? You don't want to be having to go back to work at 75 years old, 80 years right. old, because you didn't plan right.
Yeah. And I definitely agree with your view. Not everyone wants or needs an ongoing relationship with an advisor. Some people never want one, and that's fine. And they're plenty willing and able and capable to do it themselves until something happens. You know, God forbid, you know, mental degradation, or you're no longer able to do it yourself. But for many folks, just a one-time thing, or, you know, some sort of short-term relationship, I think is all many people need, just to get the basic understanding, get yourself a roadmap, whatever it may be. I'll be the first one to say, no, I don't think everyone needs an advisor. You know, it's good to hear you say that, and know that others feel the same. The last thing I want to do is try to push the industry on people. The industry already has enough problems that it made for itself. So regarding sort of two-pronged, what do you wish you would have known or done differently when you were younger regarding both financial and non-financial aspects of where you're at now and planning for retirement?
The non-financial is easy. Paid more attention to my health, developed habits, more healthful habits, exercise, and the food that I eat. The financial, I wish I gave more thought to where I saved my money, or saved our money, right? So if you think about saving in a taxable brokerage account, right? So you pay income tax and FICA tax on that amount. Mm. And then on the growth in that amount, you pay capital gains tax, right? Or ordinary income tax if it's interest and dividends. If it's if you put your money in a tax-deferred account, you don't only pay income tax on the amount itself. You're going to pay ordinary income tax on the growth.
Yes.
So depending on where you are in the tax bracket, that income tax may or may not be greater than the 0 to 15% capital gains rate, right? And then if you have money in Roth, it's, you know, you pay income and FICA tax just on the contribution, and all growth is tax free. So, and then the HSA, you escape income tax, you escape FICA tax, you escape capital gains tax. So, I saved in all those vehicles, but I didn't give a lot of thought to, okay, prioritize this over that. So that's one thing that I wish I had done before retirement.
That's good. A lot of people have the majority of their investable assets in pre-tax accounts, like traditional 401k IRA. And that's a common theme now is, oh, I wish I didn't have so much money here and instead had some in a regular brokerage account or a Roth account of some sort.
But, yeah.
You know.
And long-term care, I didn't pay attention to long-term care needs when I was still working. It should have hit me earlier, especially since I was witnessing what was happening with my parents. You know, I got closer to them, and it was difficult too, though, because they weren't very forthcoming with where their finances were. I gave them something like this. I don't know if you can see it. I'm dead, now what? You know,
oh, okay. Like when the book you leave to your heirs.
Yeah. So when you pass away, so you know, organizing, so it's not such a mess for them. Right. I gave them something similar to that shortly after my age 50, and periodically I would ask them about it because I just didn't know. Never got completed. So, yeah, now I'm still trying to get the information from them so I can help more.
Yeah. That's a great idea for everyone listening and watching. It's hard for people to do, to think about your own mortality and think of it in such matter of fact terms. Like, it's going to happen. If it does, let me at least try to make sure I minimize the impact and hassle and inconvenience and work for those left behind. Some people, my mom included, has always maintained this large book. I think she literally calls it, like, If I Die. Anytime she goes somewhere, she leaves it on her dining room table. You know, she's flying somewhere, so I know exactly where it is if I need it. She's clearly plenty comfortable talking about her mortality and planning around it. But I know other folks, absolutely not. They won't even think about the possibility of dying, let alone go so far as to look it in the face and make such detailed plans around it, such as to keep a binder and discuss it with someone. So if practical, you know, I recommend everyone get as comfortable and do as much as they could in the pre-planning, the forethought, the leaving what you need to know information for your heirs. Because it could be quite daunting to have to administer someone's estate on top of the emotional pain of having lost someone you love, now to deal with the often boatload of operational logistical things that come with it at such a delicate, tender, stressful time. The people will greatly appreciate, you know, and anything you can do to help make that easy and get the knowledge for them. So kudos to you and to everyone listening who does that. Well done.
Yeah. So, but I didn't buy long-term care insurance. I didn't pay attention to getting long-term care insurance, right? And so now I'm self-funding. And when I think about long-term care, I just don't think about the high expenses towards the end of life, right? Mm-hmm. Usually that's what people talk about, last 3 years of your life or whatnot. I think about, one of my priorities is living comfortably till the end of life, right? So I have earmarked assets or budgeted amounts that are going to be spent when I turn 85 or when Lee turns 85, because I want to be comfortable at that age.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it means getting more assistance, hiring more people. That's what we want to do. So not just the medical expense and all of that stuff. All the other stuff that older people, elderly need.
You have accounted for. Yeah. Okay. Great. And so you mentioned Lee doesn't really want to know much unless it comes from Twitter or TikTok, but and you're the one who's more hands-on in the process. So what do you do? And have you had discussions, or other than your big book, I guess, in the event you're no longer capable of doing this or you're not around, what's the plan for Lee at that stage to get involved or do what she needs to do?
Yeah, well, I'm slowly kind of getting her involved, slowly talking about it. And she's slowly getting on board with the need to talk about it. She hates it when I say, the problem is, what if I go before you? What are you going to do? And I, every so often, I bring that up. And so finally, I think she's listening, right? Especially because my parents are in the Philippines right now. So I've been traveling back and forth quite a bit. So I leave her here on her own for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And she needs to figure things out by herself. We would video call, but for the most part, okay, honey, we'll take care of that, right?
Right.
So I think it's hitting her more like, okay, what will I do if by chance she outlives me and she has to take care of this stuff? Yeah. So slowly it's getting there. I think I probably have to write a lot of stuff and maybe I do have to have a video for her. Yeah. But things constantly change, right? So that's the other challenge.
Yeah.
What do you do when you have to change it?
Right. Yeah. Definitely. It could be the more elaborate and robust and spelled out your, you know, if I die plan is, the more you need to update it because it will inevitably change. So then it becomes sort of like this operational task of keeping your plans and the contingencies updated. And in your case, if you're making videos or making posts on Twitter for her to read when you're gone, like, you know, updating those. Maybe you should make
such
it
a task.
I'm only half joking, but maybe you should make like a fake Twitter account or something. It's like Judy's afterlife. And so if you're gone, you can just go there and just like look at all your, you know, posts from that you've done ahead of time to teach her what she needs to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you see in the movies, right? Some action movies, and there's some, you know, parent or boss who dies and the son watches and cries and everything, and superheroes.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right. So moving on to some of the more technical and specific parts of your plan. So you mentioned, it sounds like you're on ACA from what I gather so far. Is that true? That's what you're doing for health insurance or no?
I was on ACA for the first 3 years.
Okay.
And this last couple of years, I haven't been. I'm on a private plan through my prior employer.
Okay.
Because I had to take into account, you know, I was in a high deductible plan. I had to take into account the premium subsidy, and the deductible. And I compared that with what I can get from the prior employer. And it pretty much came out almost the same, actually, surprisingly, for the plan that I wanted. A little bit more expensive. But in California, the high deductible plan, the deductible is so high. Like, I don't remember the figures right now. But let's say on the private plan, it was like $4,000. And then on ACA, it's $14,000. So it's like the difference is so high that it's a matter of what is the fixed expense and what's the variable expense. But looking at our expenses for those 3 years, there's a, you know, we use up quite a bit of the deductible before the actual insurance coverage comes in. It was better to navigate the private, easier for us to find the people, the specialists that we need. So.
Okay.
I did away with ACA. Yeah.
And can you, does your employer let you carry that plan until 65, until Medicare?
No.
Your
no.
former
so,
employer? No.
Yeah. I don't think so. It could be, but I always asked my former boss, was also my mentor, what he does, and he said it came to a point that staying in that was more expensive. So he went a different way, and so that's probably what I'm going to do as well.
So you might at some point before you hit 65 drop that plan and go back to ACA or something else.
Yeah, actually it's going to be sooner than that, because Lee's turning 65 before the end of the year.
Oh, okay.
I need to learn about Medicare this year.
Oh, there you go.
Before that happens. Yeah.
That'll be some fun homework.
Yeah.
Social Security, what's your strategy and plans around that, claiming Social Security?
Currently, it's full retirement age for Lee, and the latest age 70 for me. But I've been thinking about, you know, every year you defer after full retirement age, you get about an 8% increase, right?
Yes.
So I've been thinking about, let's say the 8% increase is $200 a month, for example, or if you delay 2 years, it's $400 a month, right? How much do I need to spend today to buy an annuity with cost of living adjustment to replace $400 a month? When I do that math today, it's more expensive to buy that annuity. You know,
right.
Higher premium than what I would receive for those first 2 years. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe we wait for Lee to start. Maybe she's also at 70. So So I adopted what I think what it's conventional thinking, you know, the lower earner, the lower Social Security benefit starts sooner than the higher one. But I'm rethinking that to see if is that really what's optimal for us. I think the older we get, the more I want guaranteed, quote unquote, sources of income.
Right.
And so what am I willing to pay to make the guaranteed sources of income as high as possible?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I won't put words in your mouth, but I guess the quote unquote guaranteed, you're probably referring to the fact that Social Security could be changed at any time.
Yeah.
Could be reduced, could be, you know, take away or have less inflation increases, et cetera. But as it stands now, it is one of the best, if not the best, inflation adjusted annuities a person could have. My opinion, my two cents is that anyone who's on Social Security or close to it, so I'll say late 50s or above, I can't picture a scenario where their benefits get cut or otherwise materially altered, other than I think the more of Social Security will become taxable for people. I think that's low-hanging fruit. Whereas, you know, now at most 85% of it could be taxable federally. I'm guessing that goes to 100 at some point, or maybe just for certain people in certain income ranges. But as far as like wholesale reductions to people's benefits, I can't picture a world where it happens to anyone over 50 something. So I suspect you're safe and, you know, taking the play that why not delay as much as possible to squeeze as much out of these as we can. I'd be comfortable with that. I wouldn't worry about it getting cut and there goes your plan. So
yeah.
Roth conversion. Yeah, this is always a fun. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think most when they prepare for retirement, right? The advice is okay. Understand all your expenses and all of that, making sure you cover all expenses. In my mind, what you've got is what you've got, and you need to know how much that is. What can I spend, and live within those parameters? Live within your means. So. If anything happens to Social Security or whatnot, or market turns goes south or whatnot along the way, then you need to be flexible and resilient. And what is it? How low can it go, or how bad can it be before you really can't live that way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think so it's kind of like, this is what I've got. This is what I got to live with. And therefore, if this means cutting expenses, then get cut.
Right.
And also kind of like a dive at zero. We don't have kids, right? So we want to be able to spend what we've got during our lifetime on us, on people we love in charity. So that also means, hey, we've got enough funds to do that expensive vacation this year. And so let's do that. But it's constantly watching, what does it look like? How much do I think would be, if my assumptions hold true, how much would be left at the end of life?
Right.
And because assumptions never hold true, right? I'm always wrong. Everybody's always wrong about the future. Then make that adjustment as actual events turn out wrong than you assume.
Yeah.
And to this point, I think the preciseness of projections is sometimes, you know, it's only useful to the extent, right? In every instance, you're just making your best guess, and you need to be flexible enough and resilient enough and know what's the breaking point for you and avoid that breaking point. Get everything situated so you don't fall into that breaking point. And the plan's no good. So
yeah, no, I think you're spot on. Even in retirement, this stuff is a bit of a moving target. Projections are just that: guesses about the future of the market, about future of inflation, about the future of your health, when you're going to leave this world. All these things, tax legislation, nobody knows. Even the what you think is the most rock solid, best laid plan is still subject to exposure to unknown variables And so people need to go into retirement realizing I did the best I can do with what I have, with what I know, with what I think I know. Part of it will be wrong. And you have to have the willingness and ability to adapt and be agile and tweak things around as necessary. So I think some people don't get that or realize or don't think about that until life happens, for good, for bad, for indifferent. Mm-hmm. Change will happen throughout retirement, right? So
yeah,
how you deal with it is what's really going to drive the success or lack of success in your plans. Roth conversions. This is a big one. Topic du jour for a while. Do you do Roth conversions? What's your view, stance? How do they fit into your plan, if at all?
I have done Roth conversions. I'd say a little bit more aggressively than I probably needed to. But learning from your podcast, one of the first learnings was asset location.
Okay.
Right. And putting certain types of investments in you know, tax deferred or Roth or taxable to optimize or attempt to optimize anyway or mitigate paying lots of taxes, right? So with the Roth conversions that I've been doing, plus having the slower earning assets in the tax deferred account, so fixed income investments in the tax deferred account, it hasn't been growing as much as the other pots of money.
Good.
This year, I've been thinking about, do you do the Roth or do you do the 0% capital gains tax? Because I'm looking at my unrecognized gains and losses with the market recovery. It's gone up again, unrecognized. So I'm thinking, I have 2 years, and in 2 years, my pension starts. In 2 years also would be, Lee is full retirement age, right? So that's when these income that's going to certainly put us at a certain tax bracket, that's when it all starts. So I have 2 years to decide whether is this the time to whittle down that unrecognized capital gains, or do I continue with the Roth conversions? It seems to me I have a lot more years to do to continue doing the Roth conversions, and I have a limited time to do to address the unrecognized capital gains issue. So I'm leaning towards addressing that issue for the next couple of years.
Okay. That's a great consideration. Once you have the pension and Social Security on, that's going to fill up most or not all, you know, crowd you out of the 0% bracket for capital gains. So it's like you said, a couple of years left, use it or lose it. Now, I wish we'd be able to know 10, 20 years from now which one ended up being the better decision to take advantage of the capital gains or Roth. We'll never know. That's part of like why it's so easy to spin your wheels and get lost in analysis paralysis. But it's good that you're thinking about the opportunities and the angles, at least, so you're making an informed decision for it. Home. Do you own a home? And if so, what's the plans around that to potentially move, downsize? Do you ever consider a reverse mortgage at some point, et cetera?
Yeah, we own a home. It's fully paid. I paid it before I turned 50. We paid it. Lee has always said this is the home. We will stay here, right? But lately, a conversation has started, you know, the possibility of this not being our forever home, that's come into the picture. Especially before, there were four of us living here. My parents were living with us. Now there's two of us. It's an empty nester in a different sense. My parents moved away. So, but now it's, you know, do we need all this space? And the upkeep is, I'm getting lazy about it. She's still into it. You know, she's still into the gardening and the pool and the whatever problems, and she's more and more taking care of whenever there's a, you know, pest control visit. She's taking care of that, but I'm getting lazier. I used to take care of all of that. And then of course the equity has gone above the exclusion. So now I'm thinking, okay, How do we get out of this? If we do move, how do we get out with the least amount of taxes? And at one time I told her, if I die, when I die, that's when you sell.
Right.
If you survive me. And she remembers that when I say, you know, maybe we should move now. And then she would say, oh, but I thought the best time is when one of us dies because of the step up. So she remembers that. And I have to think about, that's true. So, but, you know, so much is tied to the house and it's too big. So we begun thinking of moving. But it's hard. We do like what we have. We like the area, and at some point, you know, some things become more important than the tax consequences. So
right.
We'll see.
Housing is an interesting one because many people think they have their forever home, but I've seen it enough to realize forever homes are just forever for now. Something will change, yeah. Right? You know, one extreme, health circumstances or loss of spouse is what leads you to say, I want out or I need out, or just change of, I don't know, change of part. Like you said, you used to like the house. You still like the house, but like the upkeep of the house, the being involved in the maintenance sounds like you're losing interest in. If when Lee does as well, then you two may be like, okay, you know, it's time to leave now. So another example of retirement plans always change, even with housing. You may think it's forever, but chances are it's probably not for whatever reason or host of reasons.
Yeah. So right now, because of the equity tide, like if I'm all wrong in my retirement planning thinking, then it's the backup plan, right?
Sure.
So reverse mortgage or whatever. Downsize and use the gains from it. At the same time, we don't have kids, so it may be too big a number for Plan B. So
right,
yeah.
Investments. We sort of touched on this. You mentioned your thoughts about allocation. We talked about asset location a bit. This is a pretty broad question, but can you just sort of summarize your plan maybe around investing and how you are using and or living off of your investable assets at this point?
Yeah. So what I have, our plan is our expected drawdowns for the next 10 years are in cash and fixed income, individual bonds, individual so tips and stuff like that for the next 10 years because of sequence of return, right? And anything that I don't foresee us using in the next 10 years, it's they're in equities. So again, one of my priorities is don't let emotions, you know, get the better of you. And so I had to think about, well, what is it that make me care about the market up and down? And how do I stop myself from caring about where it goes? And I kind of bounce around and this is where this is what got me into, well, I don't care because I have 10 years of budgeted expenses tied up in non-volatile or very less volatile assets. Yeah.
Good. Makes a lot for some people that bucketing and mapping out X years of expenses and cash or things that essentially can't lose value is good. Yours is probably more conservative than I've seen in having 10 years worth. But if you have the assets to do that and it's not, you know, you still have some money growing, sounds like you're going to have pension, social securities. And if it helps you manage your own emotions and knee-jerk reactions, perfect. You know, that's the right answer for you. So
actually it's not, it's close to 65-35.
Okay. And the 35 includes the 10 year earmark.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Cause okay. I was thinking, okay, well, how far off is this from the conventional 60-40, right? And because I have assets earmarked for you know, expenses when we're after our mid 80s.
Long term.
And it's a big amount. And it's I have it escalating greater than inflation, because you hear about, okay, medical costs and all this stuff are increased higher than general inflation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So because I have that earmark in the out years and it's growing faster than my normal expenses, quite a bit is tied up in equities, because it's, okay, you know, 20, 25 years away. Yeah. But over time, that will change. Over time, as we get into our 80s, it's going to be more conservative, right? Because I'm planning for 10 years of predictable drawdowns. So,
Yeah. And just curious, what rate of inflation do you assume on those longer term healthcare related monies?
I can't remember. I think it's either 100 or 150 basis points higher than my inflation assumption.
Okay.
So it's my inflation assumption is 3.5 currently. So I have that going up. So our expenses, basic expenses, I have my, what I call my minimum lifestyle budget.
Mm-hmm.
And then which includes some discretionary amount. And then I have my truly discretionary budget, which, you know, cuts off at age 80. And the truly discretionary budget is not growing as much as general inflation, the basic budget. So I have that. I have that other bucket. And then I have the third bucket, which is for long-term care. So my spending is, you know, what they call the retirement smile,
the smile,
you know, go-go year. Yeah. So the spending is that smile in my modeling. Yeah.
And I think that's pretty common. Many people in financial planning software will assume their spending is going to remain the same throughout their years, you know, plus inflation. But in reality, many times spending is pretty high initially as you're young and healthy and traveling and spending a lot on discretionary stuff, then dips down some as you cut back from some of the travel and discretionary things, and then could potentially go up again later in life as increased healthcare, long-term care costs go up. So, which complicates planning and really kind of throws a wrench in models that assumes things are neat and pretty and linear.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people actually end up spending less than they think throughout their retirements. In some cases, not the case, especially with like really expensive, really prolonged long-term care. But I anecdotally, I don't have, you know, thousands of hands-on first-hand data points to say this, but from what I gather from others and, you know, other advisors and people who've lived through retirements, said they often end up spending less than they thought they would. So.
Yeah. Well, in my modeling, for example, there are, especially when the stock market is doing well, there would be periods when I look at, you know, what's my projected balance at age 98, which is the end of our planning period, right? And sometimes it's just as much as what we have now. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not on my goal of spending most of it.
Die with zero, yeah.
But if I adjust it for inflation, it's not really that much, you know? It's only a third of purchasing power or whatever, depending on how far you are. So it's not really true that we have as much as when we just started. So, yeah. So, when people tell me sometimes, easy peasy, I have more than when I retired. But then I'm thinking, but you actually don't.
Right.
Yeah. Because inflation has eroded your purchasing power. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
True. All right. Last batch of questions here. How did you find the transition of going from working and accumulating to not accumulating anymore and taking out or, you know, using your portfolio?
Yeah, that was difficult for the first year or two. But, you know, at some point, I just needed to trust the process. For me and Lee to trust. I made Lee, you know, crazy with my changing comments about our finances, right? That there will be some days when I tell her, oh, can you please stop the silly spending, what I'd call silly spending, you know, just spending on small amounts, this and that. And then there will be other days, yeah, go ahead, honey, we can afford that. And it's a lot more expensive. So she's like, what is it?
Have you
got the numbers right? Yeah. How come some days you're all over me and other days I'm like thinking, are you sure we can afford it? Right. But so I just, you know, I'm trusting the process for now, knowing that when we have to, we would cut down when we have to. And as things happen, as real life happens, our planning changes, right? Fortunately, the truly discretionary budget is a good amount. So, you know, we can adjust. And then COVID happened right after we retired, right? So there wasn't really a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
So it kind of played into, well, I'm nervous about spending, right? And then things opened up and you're like, well, for more than a year, we haven't traveled. So let's go spend it.
Right.
And the problem is, you know, once you travel business class, then you're thinking, hard to go to economy.
Yeah.
But now that business class is what? It used to be to go to Europe, you could go for grand business class. Now it's double that or maybe even triple, depending on the venue. So it's like, are we going to spend that? No, we go back to premium economy now. And at some point, we'll probably go back to economy. So you just change as you need to.
Yeah. Okay. So now you're in retirement, what expenses have you noticed are more than you thought they'd be, and in which things are less than you thought they'd be?
My biggest expenses are taxes, travel, and health insurance, healthcare costs. Healthcare, well, it's not really surprising, I guess, because we said, okay, when it comes to our health, no skimping, right? So for example, it's more expensive not to take the ACA subsidy, but we like it better. We like the network better. We like the specials better. So yeah. So I guess, but it's still, you know, when you're used to the employer paying a lot of your medical costs, it's always an adjustment, right? When you have to pay the medical costs on your own. Travel, but maybe because, you know, we're catching up, making up for lost time. And then taxes, but that's because, you know, we've been aggressive with the raw conversions in the first few years. So it's kind of unexpected in the sense that I didn't really plan ahead for these things, but it made sense. There's a rationale for the spend. As far as what's less than I thought, I'm not really sure.
Nothing, unfortunately. Yeah.
Nothing, unfortunately. And I tend to focus on the bigger numbers, so I'm more familiar with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. What did you think would be more difficult or challenging about retirement than it actually is so far? If anything.
Yeah. Well, tax management. Right, because it's just a best guess, and I'm always second guessing myself. But it is a big spend during retirement. So that's been difficult. I didn't give it any thought pre-retirement, but now that I'm in it, it's like, oh, this is challenging, right? There's so many considerations. And then, like I said earlier, when I retired, part of it was I was so into my work. I was so busy. I couldn't think of what will I retire to? And I thought, well, when you retire, you'll have all the time to figure out what you want. But it's actually hard when you have all the time to do whatever you want. It's actually hard to
figure
it out.
You find you do nothing? Yeah.
Yeah. I could do that or that or that or no, I'll just continue sleeping in.
So. Right.
So, yeah.
My father retired a handful of years ago, and when he was working full time, he was super busy between work, you know, full day of work and taking care of his house, golf once a week, go fishing on the weekends, cut the grass. He's real into his yard and grass and gardening and just day to day running errands and whatever. And then he got it all done and he retired. And he's at no work anymore. So that just freed up whatever, 9 hours a day. And he says he struggles now to make time to do all the normal mundane errandy stuff he used to do without thinking twice about it. Now it's a struggle to prioritize his time. He's like, I don't know what I do with my day. I feel like I'm busy all day, but I don't know what I do with myself. So.
Oh, absolutely. That's true. But I think it's more when I used to work, right? When people were. It seems the day takes long. It's like, when is this day going to be over, right?
Right.
Now that I'm retired, like, where did the day go? I think because you are doing things that, whether it's not really doing anything or doing something significant, right? You're doing the things that you want.
Right.
So time just seems to, like, go by so quickly. Yeah.
Time
so even
if,
even
fun.
If... Yeah, even if, you know, I would say, well, I haven't figured out what I want to do. In reality, in the moment, I'm doing what I want.
Right.
And so, you know, I could make myself crazy thinking, how come I haven't figured out what I want to do? Or I could accept that you're living a good life because you're doing what you want. You may not think it's something, but
right,
yeah. And so Lee tells me that because she didn't have a hard time transitioning into retirement. I did. I'm thinking, well, maybe I should do this. Maybe I should be a financial planner, or maybe we should, you know, continue selling on Amazon, which we did right after retirement. When she's like, I'm done working. No, I don't want to do that. I just want to tend to the plants and do this and that. And it was an easier transition for her, but not for me. And I was talking to a friend of mine before about this, and I think it's your age, Judy, because you retired too early at 55. And now that I'm 60, now I'm on the same mindset. Work? What's that?
Right.
No, I don't want to do that.
It's a four-letter word. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I get it. What was some of the worst or most inaccurate advice you were given or read about retirement?
My pet peeve, the 4% rule.
Yes.
Yeah. I when I heard about it, oh, that sounds good. Okay. And then, but I see it used in so many situations that's inappropriate. Like the early retirees, the people who retire at 40. And then it just scares me like, no.
Right,
the study was for, you know, people under 60. And this is the asset allocation. And in their 50s, think about, you know, their Social Security. Or other source of income. And in the old days when Bengen did that study, who knows if, you know, the person had a pension and stuff like that, right? Which most young people don't have now. So 4% rule applied in all situations, that's just bad. So
agreed.
Even as a rule of thumb, I think it's bad. You know, and a better rule, I think, is okay, I have, let's say, $1 million and I have 40 years. If I don't spend it, I mean, if I don't earn any, so $1 million divided by 40 years is one answer. $1 million, if I'm to divide that over, you know, 60 years of remaining lifetime, because I retire early, that's a different answer. That's a much smaller number. Can you live with that?
I mean, right.
No, of course, you know, it's a different answer for everybody, but the age needs to be considered. Other resources need to be considered. And that's what I think the misapplication of the 4% rule is.
Yeah, I think that's 100% agree with you. That's so misunderstood, misused, misapplied by advisors alike who don't really understand the findings and the research that went into the study that has since been called the 4% rule. You know, Bengen, who did the research, never called it a rule. He was just doing like a academic exercise. Oh, I wonder what would have worked historically based on these assumptions. And that's what it was. And the industry since took it and ran with it and called it a rule. And it's been so misapplied.
I mean, if 4% works and 3% works, right? If the problem is what drawdown would it be for me not to outlive my assets, right? Well, okay, 4%, true. 3%, also true.
True.
2%, even truer.
Right. 0%, can't lose. How about that? Right. What were the most surprising things about retiring, both financial and non-financial, if you didn't already address it through, you know, other questions?
I didn't plan for, I didn't think about being this involved with my parents,
mm-hmm.
And looking after them. But maybe because I don't have kids, right? And I'm already retired, so maybe I can focus that. Because I think about my siblings, for example, and I think about my mom sometimes. You know, she would be sad that the others aren't calling us often. But my siblings are busy. They're still working, and mm-hmm. some of them have kids, and that's taken up a lot of their time. Or we have the time to do it, right? And we are in a financial position to be always be in touch, whether in person or virtually. There's cost involved, right? In wanting to be closely involved in what's happening with them. And I didn't plan for that. We didn't plan for that. We didn't plan for them living with us. We remodeled the house so it'd be more convenient as they aged. That we planned for. That was budgeted for. This situation that we're in right now, where they're living in a different country, and they still need help. Whether they're there or they're here, they need help. So that entails additional money involved. I didn't plan for that.
Okay.
So.
And then final question, if you can give only one piece of advice or guidance to others about retirement planning, what would it be?
I think I mentioned it before, no single investment or asset is the answer to all risks that retirees face. So sometimes when I see posts in the Facebook group about, you know, choosing between a lump sum and a pension, and the anonymous poster already disclosed that I have all this liquid invested assets, and I'm thinking, why? And then they have a question about how to invest, and I'm thinking, why add to the dilemma that you already have on proper investing by taking the lump sum? Why don't you take the pension, right? So there is not And then the annuity word. The annuity word is such a four-letter word. But there are good and there's bad. And to your point, the industry is not in a it doesn't have a good reputation currently.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. And so I think the annuity is bad because of the people who force it or sold it in situations that different kinds of annuities where it's not appropriate or people didn't really understand what they're buying. But there's a place for it in retirement, in my mind anyway. So yeah, it's probably that. It's not thinking about, well, you know, I'd rather take a lump sum or I'd rather have all this invested assets than have it tied to let my prior employer take care of that or let the government, you know, not pay me my Social Security. I'd rather take it now because who knows what would happen, right?
Yeah.
Because there are just different risks and you need to consider all those risks and think of how best to address each risk.
You know, and everyone's situations and risks will be slightly different. So there is no like universal dogmatic approach to doing any of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, this was great. Thank you very much, Judy, for taking the time and sharing and opening up. It's highly valuable. And I'm sure a lot of people will get a lot out of it.
Oh, I hope so. And thank you again for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on. It was a definitely good time and very much appreciate it. Keep up the good work in the Facebook group. Seriously, you are one of the day one folks, and I greatly value all of your contributions and knowledge shared there. So thank you.
I've learned a lot from being in the group.
All right.
Bye.
Take care, everyone. Okay, that's it. Hope you all enjoyed my chat with Judy. I know I did, learned a lot from it. It's always great to sit down with real people and hear what their experiences have been, what their pain points are or were, how their retirements are coming along relative to what they thought they'd be or hoped they'd be. So, and I hope you all are finding it fascinating, insightful, and good learning experiences as much as I am. If you haven't already, please check out the retirementplanningeducation.com website where you can find not only this podcast, but also link to the Facebook group, YouTube videos where the videos are directly piped into the group. You don't have to actually leave to go to the YouTube channel, and a whole bunch of freely downloadable stuff, charts, checklists, summaries, helpful hints, etc. Some that I made myself, others that I bought through a third-party service and just sort of recycle and send out to you all. Also, if you do like this podcast, it'd be greatly appreciated if you would take a moment to leave a glaringly positive review on whatever podcast listening platform you use. I would be super, super thankful. And stick around for next week where I will have this month's Q&A edition of the podcast. Those are always a fun time. All right. Thank you as always for listening. Take care. See you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.